Welcome to Ars Politica, a podcast on political life, culture, and Christian political theory, with Stephen Wolfe and Thomas Acord. We seek to revitalize the Christian West and to restore the dignity, strength, and self-respect of Western civilization.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Ars Politica podcast. I am Stephen, and he is Thomas. And today, all right, so today we are going to introduce our plan for the future, which is going, it's our long-term plan to go through a series of classical works, very ancient works. You've probably heard of them. Iliad, Odyssey, and the Aeneid. And we're going to go through these over time, probably every other week. And we're going to publish a calendar of when we're going to read these, so you can actually read along. And we're going to offer our interpretation of them. And Thomas is going to provide his expertise, and I'll do whatever I can do. I guess the question is, why are we doing this? This podcast is kind of this big idea from, you could say, the right, or from kind of a commitment to Western civilization, all that sort of thing. Why are we going to go through slowly, painfully, not painfully, go through all these different books of kind of ancient epics? And I don't want to answer that question. I'm gonna have Thomas answer that question. So why are we doing this?
Yeah, well, there's a quote from C.S. Lewis in his introduction to, I think, God on the Dock. And it's an essay that he wrote. And he says in it that every age has its own outlook. It is especially good at seeing certain truths and especially liable to make certain mistakes. We all, therefore, need the books that will correct the characteristic mistakes of our own period. And that means the old books. He says, the only palliative is to keep the clean sea breeze of the centuries blowing through our minds. And this can be done only by reading old books. End quote. So C.S. Lewis thinks that we should read old books to step outside of our own age. And even people, he says, who happen to be opposed in their viewpoints, like liberals and conservatives today, who seem diametrically opposed, they still assume some of the basic philosophical points. If you step out of this time 1,000 years hence, you'll see that. But we can't do that. We can't go in the future. We can, however, go in the past and get a perspective on our own day and age by looking from the standpoint of those who've come before us. And Lewis recommends actually reading an old book for every new book you read. And what's interesting, too, with the classical model of education is that people today think that Plato is too hard, too complicated to read, and so you have to read summaries of Plato written by the experts. But what C.S. Lewis notes is that the experts are actually more difficult to understand than Plato. They're more boring as well, he says. And in fact, if you're a newbie, if you're a beginner, you should actually start with the classics, because this is probably not everybody, but many people today, you go through education, you go through school, you actually never read the books that are from the past. You read summaries of Shakespeare, you read snippets of what Boethius had to say, but you never read Dante himself. And what Lewis says is these books, however, have stood the test of the ages as something true, something good, something worthwhile, and said beautifully. And so you should sit in them, you should read them, you should go to the sources. And there's so many reasons for this too, even Christian reasons, which we can get into. But that's one big reason for why we're doing this podcast.
So I went to public school, and I don't recall reading any of these books. And I mean, this episode's not so much about education, but there is the fact that our modern education doesn't see any need to read these old classics. At least when I was growing up, it was a matter of need. Why do you need to read these things when they don't have any sort of practical? They don't have a clear practical use. They're kind of ancient. And it's just kind of a mental, like at best this, I don't know, leisurely exercise that you go through. Nowadays, people are just downright hostile to this idea. One motivation I had for this is I thought it was hilarious. A couple, I think it was about a month ago, that there was kind of it's been going on for about 2 or 3 months. There's kind of a fight among classicists. I don't know if you saw some of this, Thomas, but there was like fight among classicists over whether or not these should be taught as part of your regular, you know, the curriculum of your college education. On one side, they're saying that it's dangerous because they're all dead white masculine men or something like that, and the other side acknowledges that and says yes, but we can critique them or whatever. And one of the titles of I think it was a Washington Post article said something to the effect of don't give the classics to the alt-right, which that's just hilarious. that needed a defense. And her defense was ultimately to you can use this to critique, like she brought up the Aeneid and said that, well, you can use that to critique political propaganda. And so it was this kind of this like critical approach to it. And I think what's, as people of the right, I mean, I'll say that I'm a right-wing guy. I think I'm perfectly fine with them giving it to us. And part of this podcast is to say that, look, as I guess men of the right, we should be readers. And what should we read? Well, we should read the classic works of Western civilization. And we should do it with a sort of critical eye, not in order to deconstruct and then to kind of destroy or to be negative, but actually in a very positive sense. You can actually critique things in a positive way that actually provides insight into life and the world. And so part of our approach is going to be to kind of read these works in that light, and try to in some ways be practical, theoretical, with very critical eye, but positively. I can't foresee us, apart from maybe some Christian critiques, because these are pagan works, and they need to be kind of perfected in light of Revelation. But nevertheless, I think generally speaking, we're going to be very positive about these works, and I hope that everyone will read along with us as we go through them all.
Yeah, it's interesting that people critique the classics in one sense of saying it's a bunch of dead white males and we shouldn't read them, but then they'll say things like, we can use this to critique the writer. We can use it as a critical tool to analyze something or whatever. It's they kind of go back and forth in their assessment of these. And then they'll say things also like the people in the Mediterranean weren't white or something. It's like, well, where was Aristotle? Like, where was he living when he wrote this? And Homer... And a lot of these guys. I mean, some of the writers are from North Africa, and of course, nobody says that those people were the dreaded European males. So it's like on the one hand, we have to throw them out because they're dead white males, but on the other hand, they're not white. Whatever stick is good enough to beat the classics with.
Imagine spending so much of your life studying this body of literature that you actually. Right. Only use as like a negative critique of others, right. in the modern world. But that's like all of academia has become that sort of thing. You know, it's like this negative critique. Right. And the best they can do is just try to find some minority writers and this kind of rubber stamp positivity on it all. But they use basically Western canon as just this way to attack and be negative. I don't know how someone can live like that. So the idea here again is, like I said, is to provide kind of a positive and critical reading of these things that are hopefully beneficial to everyone.
So there's another point here we wanted to talk about, which was a syncretistic approach to discovering truth. The modern world looks at things from a standpoint of pluralism, where none of us have the whole truth. We're all like blind men touching the elephant. And so we need to read many perspectives in order to approximate upon truth. And you can call this pluralism. Some people today call this standpoint epistemology, or that's not what we're trying to do here, and that's not the classical approach to the classics itself. It's not that we have part of the truth and they have part of the truth so much. We're Christians. We're taking a distinctly Christian approach, which is God has revealed truth in his word and in the natural world, and those truths are evident everywhere. They manifest wherever his creation exists and wherever humans, people bearing his image. You can find this true things, good things, even beautiful things in pagan culture. And you have to be careful as you wade through it. But fortunately, many Christians have come before us and have done this. Many great thinkers have done this before us. And another thing C.S. Lewis says here is, don't worry when you read the classics. If you're a Christian thinking, why should I read the classics? Why should my kid read the classics? It's not actually that dangerous, because it's easy to see their mistakes from far away. What's more difficult is to see our own mistakes today. That kind of brings back around to the idea of why read the books. You know, I think another reason to read them is this is our inheritance, whether we like it or not. I happen to like it, but some people don't like it, and they spend their whole lives telling everybody how they don't like it. But these ideas are those that built the Western world. For instance, when we read the Iliad together, you're going to read all kinds of gods and goddesses, and you're going to be thinking to yourself, what a great tale, what a great fabricated story. But that's not how people saw it a long time ago. For instance, Alexander the Great is said to have kept a copy of the Iliad under his pillow at night when he slept. And what does that mean? It means that he read this thing and he took it seriously. He learned battle tactics and strategy, and he wanted to go conquer the same places and be a great warrior like Achilles and a great leader like Agamemnon. And he did. And because of that, because of this book that we think today is, you know, fantasy or myth or whatever, this guy took it seriously and spread Greek culture all over the near ancient Near East and Mediterranean world. And because of that, we have the influence of Greek and the Bible and architecture in Rome and all kinds of things because of this book that one guy took seriously. Julius Caesar took it seriously. Napoleon took it seriously.
What tends to happen is people say, well, it's like a, I'm gonna get in trouble here, but people say it's like a Eurocentric canon, basically, and it is. When we talk about the Western canon, we're thinking Eurocentric, and we're also thinking kind of like American or just Western generally, what you conceive of Western. We tend to think, well, you know what, the reason why we should love these works, well, it's because they're universal. Everyone can love them. Everyone can love them. And I think I'm not saying that's not possible, that other people who are, you could say, traditionally non-Western.
Right, right.
I'm not saying they can't love them. Nor am I saying that these books are not speaking of things that you could call universal. I'm just saying that it isn't, when you talk about an inheritance, we're not talking about it's some sort of, you know, Europe's gift to the world. I'd rather think of these things as a gift to people who basically take their ancestry, you could say lineage, or I suppose even identity, through into the Western tradition, into the West, you could say into Europe. So when you talk about inheritance, we're not talking again about something we can scatter across the world and everyone's going to suddenly fall in love, you know, with Julius Caesar. They're going to fall in love with Virgil. They're not going to fall in, you know, maybe they will. But generally speaking, the reason why I'm interested in teaching these things is that it's a passing on an inheritance that's kind of very particular. It's a body of literature that, even though it speaks of universal truths, is something handed down in a very kind of particular way and can be loved as a particular thing, even if it's, like I said, talks about universal ideas. So I think we should stop. I just hate the justification of why we should love these works because, well, they apply to everyone. I keep repeating myself, but that's fine. But we should love it because, yeah, it's been handed down. It's been, I mean, think about it being handed down. It's been preserved.
Right.
These works have been copied. They've been translated. They've been, you know, these preserved over centuries, millennia. And for that reason, we should be grateful. It's a sort of gift. You know, when you have these lists of these works that you can just pull off the shelf and read, it's a gift from the past. And part of being a teacher, and Thomas, you teach more than more than I have, but that sense of handing down as a tradition is just really important. Anyway, I'm rambling on, but the point is, love it as a particular inheritance, and that's hope. I hope that we can inspire people to have that similar love as well as we go through it.
Yeah, think about this for a minute. There's not, if you go back thousands of years, there are no other peoples who have stories like this. Like if you are Mexican, the canon for you goes back a couple hundred years, maybe. If you are Chinese, you actually do have a very long canon that you can reach back thousands of years. So to say, to take this canon that the Westerners have and say, it's for everybody, you're taking what belongs to you and universalizing it and making yourself the center of everything. I think a true nationalist position, to get back into politics a little bit here, is one that would say, no, we are not the universal way of being. Our way is not the way for every human all over the face of the earth, and that's okay. We're not here to impose this on everyone and to say that this is applicable to everyone at all place and all time. Now, there are things that happen inside these books that are universal, like jealousy and passion and things like that. But, for instance, the development of battle strategy that you can follow through these books is particular to the West. The development of political thought, you can draw a straight line from the Iliad to the Oresteia to the Odyssey to the Aeneid to Dante to, it's a, you know, on and on and on, straight down the Western canon. You can't do that with other traditions.
Yeah, I mean, try to read something like Milton's Paradise Lost and not understanding classical culture and Christian culture.
That's right.
Or just Western culture broadly. It wouldn't make any sense.
Right. Right. And so there's a reason why government buildings in America look like Greek buildings a little bit. There's a reason for that. And to understand that, to not understand that is to sort of walk around among your ancestors not knowing who they are. And so we want to honor our ancestors, our cultural, civilizational fathers and mothers. Stephen, can we get into defining a classic?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that good?
Yeah, you can go ahead and do that.
Okay. Yeah. So we talked about reading the classics, and we want to define a classic now. What is a classic text? There's a bunch of definitions, but I take the one that says that a classic book is one that has stood the test of time. It has spanned centuries and eras, and has spoken to many people and has been received among many people. That's one. Another part of this definition is that it takes into account the great tradition that I mentioned, this long conversation that's been going on. Sort of like science. If you think about how science is done, science is this process of gathering data and information, testing it, and then passing it on to the next people after you, and they build upon what you did. Well, that's the great tradition. That's the classic books. They build upon each other. They're in reference to each other. They continually reach back to those before them. And I think the last part of a classic that I would say is it's one that has some representation among a certain people. You have a hero. That hero represents his people. And it follows a certain character and narrative arc. These are the things that go to make up classics. And so the question is, what distinguishes a classic from other great books? Like millions of people today favor, like, you know, young people like Harry Potter or something. Surely that's a classic. Well, we won't know if Harry Potter is a classic, if, by the metric I've gave, we won't know it until a couple hundred years from now. Is it still something people are talking about, or was it a fad, and did it pass away? You can look at pop music this way, like, as an analogy. Pop music, it's the Beatles are the latest, greatest, awesomest thing you've ever heard of, and then 10, 20 years later, yeah, they were still pretty great, but they're not this thing that people still reference. I mean, maybe they are, I don't know. But just some other example, like the Backstreet Boys, or I don't know, Justin Bieber or something. It could be the coolest thing this year, and then it fades away. But these other things don't fade away. They're still around for thousands of years. And it's like the Mona Lisa. If you don't like it, it's not, you are not speaking properly of this objective thing that has been, it's sort of established by the annals of history. And I think that's what makes a great book.
And you can, another thing that makes things a classic is that it's works that have been, that people for a long time have taken seriously, studied, and it's all reflected in their writings and their own thinking. Plato, and then Aristotle. I mean, so the recovery of Aristotle in kind of the high Middle Ages, I mean, revolutionized in some ways a lot, Christian thought, at least in its expression. So you can see it in Aquinas, but then you can see just Roman legal influence and people like Machiavelli, Dante, other people who have been influenced by Rome, and then of course influenced by Athens, and so there is this core canon that you can't really understand history, you can't really understand the institution, like historical institutions, you can't understand people's writings in the past unless you understand these classic works that they considered to be at the time to be something you have to have basically not exactly memorized, but you have to have down and also be able to, it was written in Latin originally, you need to translate into Greek and all those. I mean, really, when you study what these guys in the past were able to do, it's astounding. But so I think that's another idea, another aspect of a classical. I don't want to get too far into this, but I guess there is the controversy over. Like is like Freud a classic work? I mean, I think in the Great Book series they have Freud in there, Charles Darwin's in there. Yeah. So there is like, I don't know if you want to get into that, but there is that kind of controversy of what is a classic. Are they good books? I know like some like Thomists, I think, were complaining about Newton is in there as well in like the Great Book series. So I mean there's things like that. So it's not without controversy. I don't want to make it seem as if like all these things are just obvious and just, accept the tradition and the book list you're assigned. So there's a lot to think about, but at the very least, these books are classics. You could think just again, Aristotle, Plato, some of the Roman writers, Cicero, of course, and just see their influence throughout the century. You can't really understand. It's hard. I mean, if you pick up some American founding literature, and you read those guys, it's hard to understand exactly where they're coming from unless you also have a background in Aristotle and Cicero and other people. So very important. But again, it's like a like we're talking about, it's a sort of inheritance as well.
So for those of you listening, you can send in your answers to these questions that Stephen and I are kind of considering. What are some books published in the last 30 years or so that you think are great books? Another one is, what recently published bestsellers will not be classics? What recently published bestsellers will not be classics and why? So I mentioned Harry Potter earlier. I don't think Harry Potter is going to be a classic in 200 years. I don't think anybody's going to be reading it, in other words. But in 200 years, people are still going to be reading the Iliad. And it doesn't matter. This is the other thing, too. In our age may seem to have rejected this, but it's just a little pericope of history that has turned its back on this, on these books, and they are the, not the things going away. I think everyone can feel very sensibly that it's if anything, it's our age that is adrift and moving away.
I do. I was thinking about this a little bit earlier. I do wonder if we're in a sort of dark age.
Right.
So I was trying to think about what works in the last like 50 years or so are going to remain like true classics in the tradition. And I'm sure people, I'm curious to hear what people have as far as candidates for that. And maybe I'm just not thinking of them, but I just kind of wonder if we've just kind of gone off course so much in kind of the post like World War II period, that pretty much we've almost like cut off the line of the tradition. I don't know, that this could be completely wrong. But yeah, you do wonder all these classics people read nowadays, you think that, or what people think are going to be classics. Do we really have the, are these the sort of conditions that are producing these great timeless works?
Right.
I mean, think of like Athens, like classical Athens with, Plato and Aristotle and Sophocles, Aristophanes, all these guys around the same period almost.
Right.
Are producing
That's
these
right.
works that are in the, like literally in the Western canon. And that time was kind of a crazy period of time in Greek history as well. I mean, that's part of the reason why those works were created. But you wonder, if even despite our crazy times now, if there's really anyone producing these timeless classical works that really seek after the sort of, or go after these perennial questions that will allow them to endure. I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll see. I mean, I guess I really hope that something like Harry Potter doesn't become a classic in our definition. I think something went wrong if that's the case.
Well, one thing people say in critique of that is that the classics are not written. The classics are declared to be so by the hegemonic forces of the day. It's not even that there's really this Western canon. It's just that powerful Europeans got together and wanted to solidify their identity, and so they created this Western canon to say that they're to justify their civilizational power, and it's this big propaganda piece, and et cetera, that was created in the Victorian era or the early 1900s, you know, by Mortimer Adler or the Encyclopedia Britannica or something. But I think that's a false. That's false. So. Your interpretation is right. The classics, every era, every civilization does seem to have an epoch of a literary golden age. And this has been recognized throughout all ages. It wasn't invented in the modern world, that this canon, it was recognized long ago. As even Augustine, for instance, recognized that the ancient Greek writers had written something great, something to be wrestled with in over thousands of pages. The Romans realized this about the Greeks. The Greeks in the classical period recognized this about Homer and the Homeric era. On and on and on. So each stage of development looked backwards and affirmed the one that had come before it as having been this great, you know, developed this great tradition for itself and something to be studied, mimicked, and adapted to their own age. So, again, you're going to hear a lot of critique, perhaps a lot of hot takes. You know, people saying things that are old as though they're actually new arguments. And that's one of them. But I think Stephen's point here is correct. So I think one great classic that might end up being a classic. People may disagree with me here, but I think Tolkien's Lord of the Rings could be there. It's mythic. It's epic. It's a tour de force of themes, of depth. It reaches back into the past. That's another thing too. The one way to make sure that your art or your creation does not last more than 5 or 10 years is to create it without reference to anything that's come before you. when you do that and you're trying to find your own self-expression, your own individuality, you'll realize that you're creating something that's not within this strong tradition of humanity. But Tolkien purposely tried to go the opposite direction there. And I think he created something that people were going to be reading and referring back to for a really long period of time. That's a classic. I don't think, people may not like me for this, I don't think Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia will be a classic. I'm sorry. I like them, but I don't think they will be. I think he was creating something unique to himself.
As I was thinking through this, I was thinking through some people who have influenced me, and you think, you know, I want those guys to become classics. I really like someone like Roger Scruton, who kind of shaped me a lot in my view of politics. Yeah. But then he's also, you think about it, he's definitely a kind of a man of his time, and almost like this is not a show about Scruton today. We should do one of those. But it seems like his influence would be something that, well, he would go away, because now he's not as, if you've kind of lost your place, then if you feel like you've lost your civilization, then Scruton's not going to help you a lot, because he's all about loving your place in civilization. So you right. think about, well, is he right. going to be kind of like this classic figure, and then what book? So yeah, it's difficult for me to. It's hard because you wonder again. I mean, what was someone like Plato and Aristotle? Were they writing thinking this is going to be a classic, or they were writing that this is going to be read by a few people within my little sphere of influence and in my city state?
Yes,
and then became this thing that's read for all the ages. And you never know when something's going to kind of brought back, revitalized, and made relevant again. And you kind of hope guys like Scruton that'll happen to them. I was thinking too of someone like you're talking about how people, if they don't take anything from the past, then they're not going to be kind of meaningful, or they're not going to remain a classic. I think someone like John Locke's Second Treatise, that just comes to my mind, where people read that and they think, oh wow, this is groundbreaking at his time. But no, it wasn't. I mean, so much of what's in Second Treatise is already found elsewhere, and he just brought it together at the right time, and it became very highly influential. It's very much based upon, and some people won't like this idea, but it's very much based upon kind of the Protestant political tradition, and he just synthesized it and packaged it into something that became influential to this day. So there is a sense, like you said, that the classics are something that belong or kind of situate themselves in a tradition, even if they don't explicitly acknowledge it. They're still nevertheless in a tradition. But trying to be kind of radically new all the time and breaking from the past is just kind of makes it so that you're going to it's hard to see that as becoming
you've mentioned
classic.
You've mentioned the influence of a book several times, and that is determining its classical status. And I think there's some truth to that. And I mentioned Alexander the Great. Aristotle was the tutor of Alexander the Great. And who knows what would have become of Aristotle's work if Alexander wasn't his disciple. Because Alexander, what's interesting about this, by the way, if you're a teacher, Alexander the Great did not listen to Aristotle's views on politics. Aristotle said all kinds of things, and then Alexander was like, okay, I'm going to go conquer people and, you know, do my thing. But Alexander the Great did end up loving the civilization of Aristotle. And there's something profound to be said there. Your students may not agree with you on everything that you tell them, but one of the higher goals of being a teacher is to get the students to love what you love. And I think Aristotle did that. Maybe it just happened. I don't know if he did it, but it happened. And because Alexander the Great was so great, and he took this Greek culture and Greek learning and just smeared it all over the known world at that time, Aristotle's writings most of which, by the way, were just lecture notes, became wildly popular and famous from that day on. It wasn't hundreds of years later people picked up Aristotle and were like, whoa, look at what we found. No, right then and there, it was very influential from that moment. And it helped the development of science, the development of Greek theology and law, ethics, rhetoric, speaking, oratory, and so many things. It affected so much, and it was influential to such a high degree, and we call that a classic. And the same is true with literature. The crystallization or expression of a whole era in one body of work, that's a classic. And we want to focus on some of the ancient classics in the next coming months.
Yeah, so just to kind of wrap this up, so we are going to, like I think I said earlier, we're going to kind of publish somehow a calendar of what we're going to read and discuss. And so if you want to read with us, just kind of follow along. We're going to read the Iliad first. It's going to be books 1 through 4. And we'll probably, I think we're going to record this next week. We haven't put together the calendar yet. We're probably going to record reading or to discuss book 1 through 4 of Iliad next week, which means that the episode will probably be put out on either the Friday or when do we usually put these things out? Thursday or Friday? Mm-hmm. Depends on when we can record, when we can find the time. But anyway, next week. So if you have a copy, Thomas, you want to talk about translations or sure. Where they can get a free versions online?
So we're going to be using Robert Fagel's translation of the Iliad and the Odyssey. It's the colorful book. It's usually a standard work. You can find that. But if you don't want that, go to a website called poetryintranslation.com. And there's a guy named A.S. Klein. He's translated many works in many different languages. And his translation is not poetry, it's prose. However, it's very readable. And it's all hyperlinked with names and places for you. It's also titled. Every section through the readings are titled, so that you kind of know what's going on. One of the problems when I teach through this, we start with 7th grade, and we read the Iliad and the Odyssey in 7th grade in my class, in my school. And the kids have difficulty knowing what's going on for 50 pages with no title of anything. And this guy's work is very, very helpful to understand the scenes, so to speak. I wanted to say also regarding translations, some people talk about one translation is better than the other. Why are you using this one or that one? I'm not an expert in language, but I have taken several years of Greek and several years of Latin, and I've taught both of those languages as well. Again, there are people that are way better than me in Greek and Latin, but I can read Greek and Latin with some facility. And I can say that the translation that you should read for any of these books is the one that helps you understand what's going on in the story. If you are that particular about one translation or another, I usually ask people if they know the original language, and most of the time they don't. And so I will try to quote from the Greek sometimes when I think it's relevant for you, like the introduction to the Iliad in Greek is pretty cool. Odyssey, in Latin, the Aeneid. But the translation you should use, in my opinion, is the one that helps you understand it.
All right. Well, if you have any questions about anything, just put it in the YouTube question or the YouTube comments. We'll try to answer those or send us an email. So just a reminder, We do have a what's it called? Patreon? Yeah, we do have a Patreon. We're not here to make money, like we like to say, but if you want to support us and pay some of these bills, you can please do that. You can find that somewhere. Is it on the webpage?
Post it in the notes, yeah.
Okay, it's in the notes, whatever. Okay. But if not, that's fine. But we look forward to talking about these things and hearing what you have to say. So see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Ars Politica. You can reach us at arspoliticapodcast@gmail.com. Leave us a comment or a like on YouTube and check us out on Apple Podcasts.
Corn liquor tastes sweeter in this town. Could it be it's the same as the last? I swear I've seen your face elsewhere before, just as familiar as a bottle and a glass. Hey, darling, sleeping on the blacktop. Hey, darling, running through the trees, honey. Hey, darling, leaving for the next town. Less than my sense catches up with me. Hey, darling, sleeping on the blacktop. Hey, darling, running through the trees.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Ars Politica Podcast. Today we are going to talk. Let me start over. We should introduce who we are. I just realized that the other day that some people have no idea who we are or who's talking. Okay. So I'll just say something like, I'm Steven, he's Thomas. Anyway, this is being recorded. Hello.
I'm uploading all of this, by the way. This is good.
You always threaten that. I don't know if you actually do that.
No.